This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. It is our Brainwaves series for the month, and joining me as always is neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar. How are you doing today, Dr. Azlina?
I'm good. Thank you so much. It's been so hot though.
It is. It's been very hot. Hopefully, people are hydrating. Although it is, the fasting month, people are also, I guess, watching what they eat a bit more. Hopefully, you want to eat properly. You want to eat right when you are breaking your fast. So, and that brings me to our topic for today, which you suggested, Dr. Azlina, where we'll be talking about food and brain health, and more specifically dive into what ulam can bring to the table for brain health as well. Now, I think a lot of people are very familiar with ulam. It's a staple part of the diets of many Malaysians. I think many of us probably don't give it much thought when we add it to our meal on a daily basis. But there are some studies that find that eating ulam might benefit our brain, on top of course, your general health, because you are having more fiber. But what exactly is that link? We want to find out more about that, and also just looking at the bigger picture to revisit how diet affects our brain health as well. So joining Dr. Azlina and I today is Dr. Suzana Shahar, Professor in Nutrition and Dietetics at University Kebangsaan, Malaysia. And I understand that Prof. Suzana has done some research into ulam and brain health, so we want to find out more about that from her. Thank you so much for joining us today, Prof. Suzana.
Right. Thank you, Sue.
Let's start looking at the bigger picture first, right? Why are we talking about food and the brain? What's the connection? What's the gut-brain connection? Perhaps we could do a bit of a refresher on that and why it's significant.
Well, because whatever that we eat, would actually will be digested and absorbed as nutrients. And nutrients will be transported into our blood circulation for a lot of organs, and including the brain, right? So basically, some of the organs or a few of the organs might need a specific nutrients. And what most is our brains. That's why, there's a terminology of brain food. So there are specific food that need to be consumed by the brain for it to be, play its role in memory function, delaying aging-related disease such as, for example, dementia, which is one of my interests and which is irreversible. So that's basically the connection between the gut and also the brain, and in relation to the food.
Anything you'd like to add, Dr. Azlina?
I guess with the ulam, we're always looking for things that will make us smarter, make us live longer, better. So there's always going to be an interest in that kind of approach in our diet.
And actually, before we get into that, to elaborate more on what you said, Prof. Suzana, what happens to the brain when we don't have sufficient nutrients to feed it?
Well, if we don't have a special, a specific nutrients to feed the brain, so we might have problem for brain signalings, for memory and so on. For example, like we know for growing up children, they need iron, zinc for brain development. So if we don't, the children didn't get enough like iron and zinc, so we can see a problem with delayed growth, mental retardation, low IQ and not performing well at schools and so on. So we see that case very, very much in like developing countries or a poorer section of the community of which malnutrition or nutrient inadequacy is persistent.
Now we know that our diet is meant to be, everything in moderation, right? And everyone is familiar with the food pyramid of having, needing to eat more fibers and fewer foods that are high in fats or sugar. But I mean, a lot of our diet nowadays is unfortunately a lot of processed food, a lot of food that's high in fats and sugar and things like that. How does that affect our brain health or its function? Does that impact the nutrients that the brain receives?
It can actually influence the brain directly or indirectly. Mm-hmm. Like, there is also my study looking into the sugar. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time, we know about the pro-oxidant or the antioxidant or the good food for the brain, but how about the bad food? So interesting enough, when we look into the diet of the older adults and we look into the level of the sugar intake, and we found that older adults who are consuming more sugary diet, which is the refined sugar as compared to the complex carbohydrate from rice and so on, they have a poorer cognitive function, right? So the mechanism might not be straightforward, but it can be related to like sugar would influence the diabetes, chronic disease, vascular condition and so on. That can actually result in a poorer, you know, brain function, affect memory and so on.
Mm.
That's something that, you know, people don't see, because if you talk about sugar and diabetes,
mm-hmm.
I think our population is like what we call is immune to that, because diabetes is so rampant. Mm-hmm. Then they don't afraid of, or they don't get scared of getting diabetes. Like, but when you talk about dementia and we say that sugar is also related to dementia, and then they know that dementia is you know, there's no cure, no medication and so on. So information like this would actually, you know, bring, you know, ring a bell to the public to cut down sugar, for example.
Yeah, I think probably as well, like if most people who tend to consume a lot of these sort of, you know, fast food, maybe they're living that kind of lifestyle, which isn't so healthy anyway. So, I mean, I think it's probably quite rare for us to find someone who eats a lot of fast food, but then they also eat a lot of fruit and vegetables. You know, it's kind of just not kind of their thing sometimes. Mm. So it's all sort of interconnected as well. You know, it's not probably not just the fast food, but just their lifestyle.
Mm, your overall lifestyle, right? I mean, know how much of an influence that has on your overall health, you know, if mm-hmm. you, when your habits itself are not healthy. Now, if we dive into your research, Prof. Susanna, I know our discussion is going to focus quite a bit on ulam, because that's one of your areas of research. But I want to find out from you, why research ulam in particular, and it's specifically its impact on brain health, because it feels like, you know, this is the type of food that a lot of people just like, this is just so normal, right? Why would you research ulam?
Yeah, because I started my research from my PhD on aging in mm-hmm. the United States, you know, mid-90s, right? So at that time, we just see the problems of nutrient inadequacy, and a bit later, we are seeing obesity and then diabetes and so on, right? And then we realized that with the increase in number of aging population in Malaysia, we are seeing more and more cases of dementia, mild cognitive impairment. And what worries more is there's no cure for dementia. So there is a need for us to look into the prevention strategies. And we know that in non-communicable diseases, one cause of it is from diet and lifestyle, of which we can prevent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we start look into our own food or functional foods. So actually we started with tropical foods.
Mm.
We publish on tropical foods. So we document things like roselle, our own guava, and the tropical foods consumptions with healthy aging and so on. Then we said, oh, how about ulam? And when we look into ulam, there's a lot of research on ulam in Malaysia, but still look into the non-communicable diseases like ulam with diabetes, ulam with hypertension, ulam with you know, heart disease and so on. But there's no research on ulam and the brain.
Mm.
And as I mentioned that when, you know, we in the public health, I'm also a dietitian, right? When we talk about prevention of diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, people don't get scared of this kind of diseases because it's sort of common for everybody to
it's
have.
It's so normal, that. Right?
Normal. But when we say something about dementia or kidney disease, so they would try to research and to look into what foods that can actually prevent this kind of diseases. So that triggered us to look into ulam. So actually, earlier on, I started with just a simple research look into the ulam consumption among women in Kelantan. And we collaborated with dermatologists at that time, Dr. Mm. from HCTM. And we looked into their ulam consumption, their hydration status, and also their skin pigmentation, skin analysis and so on. And To our surprise, we found that those women who consume more ulam, they have a better skin integrity, elasticity, and less pigmentation. So awet muda or more beautiful lah. But we didn't publish that. But from there, we applied another grant to look into the ulam and the brain and cognition. And we had, study funded lah.
And I'll get into, you know, what your studies have found out so far about ulam and the brain. But first, right, just to set some definitions as well. I think a lot of people might have very different ideas of what ulam is. Perhaps could you explain, you know, what would be considered as ulam? You know, is there a scientific definition for it, or is it more like a cultural definition? Because I feel like I used to think that ulam refers to any raw vegetables, but please do correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, actually, there's no specific definition of what is ulam. Mm-hmm. In fact, when we presented our study, also we were sort of asked about this, and there is a bit of a disagreement and so on. But we, in this research, because our aim is actually to look into the functional food, so we define in our study ulam as the traditional local vegetables that usually we consume as raw, but sometimes we boil and just a bit of, you know, mixing with lime and things like that, right? So that is the definition of ulam that we use in our study. So that's another person saying, oh, how about timun? Is timun or cucumber ulam? But in our study, we didn't say timun, cucumber ulam, because timun you can get, you know, in China, in India, they also cultivate timun, cucumber and so on, even and so on. So we, to us, ulam is our own traditional local vegetables, you know. And to our surprise, there are about 120 species of ulam in Malaysia.
So, wow.
Yeah, a lot of them. Mm.
That's a lot more than I would think. You know, usually if you go out and get some food or go to the market, you only probably see a few, or you recognize only a few, right?
I think I can only name about 5. 120, wow, gosh.
Yeah.
120.
Wow.
I'm not even confident I can name the ones that are local to Malaysia.
Have you eaten any ulam soon?
Yeah, I do. I do quite regularly. I mean, but yeah, I think so. It's like very familiar with just the usual. I think, you know, ulam raja, or like sometimes they'll have like kacang panjang and stuff like that. But yeah, like beyond that, I really... But,
to us, kacang panjang is not ulam. You know, in our study lah, we define ulam as really as exotic, traditional local vegetables.
What are some examples of that? You know, if you could give some examples to our listeners.
Yeah, it's definitely ulam raja, selom, sambung nyawa, sempedu bumi, you know, petai, pegaga. So we define as ulam. And as compared to other types of vegetables, this kind of ulam, actually they have a specific properties as polyphenols or flavonoids. That might not, you know, it's only rich in ulam, but not in other types of vegetables in particular.
Interesting. So there is something that sets these ulam apart from other vegetables.
Yeah. But at the moment, there's no consensus on its definition scientifically yet. But of course, a scientific or proper definition is needed for us to actually bring ulam as a functional food.
How many of those are native to Malaysia, or is it sort of, you know, the whole of Southeast Asia?
Yeah, it's about 120, including those in the Southeast Asia.
I see. So none specifically unique to Malaysia as such, lah.
Yeah. It's common in, you know, a bit of it common in Malaysia and also Indonesia and also Thailand. And even Korea.
Oh, okay. So I guess it's something to do with the climate, right? You're able to grow all of them here. Well, let's go for a quick break now. And when we come back, you know, we'll continue our discussion and dive a bit more into the link between ulam and brain health, as well as talk about our diets and brain health in more in general as well. I'm joined today by Dr. Azina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist, for her regular Brainwave series, as well as Dr. Suzana Shahar, professor in nutrition and dietetics at University Kebangsaan Malaysia. And we're talking about ulam and brain health. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. It is our regular brainwave series. And as always, I'm joined by neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar and our special guest for this month, Dr. Susanna Shahar, professor in nutrition and dietetics at University Kebangsaan, Malaysia. Now, Prof. Susanna is joining us to talk more about ulam and brain health. And that's because her research has also looked into the link between these two. Now, a very common part of our diets, as well as another part of our health, which a lot of people are always keen on improving. I think a lot of us are very familiar with brain foods or even supplements that are always marketed as such. And, you know, that's something that I definitely want to ask both of you later what you think of supplements. But going back to your research, Prof. Susanna, you know, I know you've conducted in, quite a number of studies looking into the properties of ulam raja in particular and its benefits to brain health. Could you tell us more about you know, your studies, and what are some of the most significant findings that you've had about the link between ulam and brain health?
All right. Okay. Thank you, Sue. So, as I mentioned just now, that we got this study funded to look into ulam raja.
Mm-hmm.
Ulam raja is actually a Cosmos caudatus, is the scientific name. So, if we look into, actually for this study, we screen quite a number of ulam,
mm-hmm.
Consumed among Malaysian adults. And we look into the nutrient profiles. And we look into the profiles, what type of ulam that has the most of polyphenols, antioxidants and so on. And we found that ulam raja is superior as compared to other ulam. So no wonder that, you know, the old folks call our ulam raja as ulam raja, because the king of the ulam, right? So, and then after we screen this ulam and look into its nutrient profiles, and we found it's high in antioxidants, and we look into the intake of the Malaysian adults and older adults just around Klang Valley, between 45 to 80 years. And we look into about 252 of them, and the average intake is about, most of them consume about at least half serving per day. And we cross-tap this with their nutrition status, you know, whether they are more overweight, underweight, and also the mood status, happier, not happy, stress, and so on. And also cognition, whether they can, you know, recall things better and things like that. And to our surprise, that we found the higher the ulam intake, the better, right? As evidence, you using the nutrition status assessment, of which those who are taking more ulam, having a, you know, lower waist circumference, more ramping, more slim, as compared to those who are not consuming ulam, and they are much more happier, and they have a better memory function as compared to those who are not taking regular ulam. And from there, we because in order for us to prove that like ulam raja has this kind of effect and so on, so we have to design a proper clinical trial. So we call it as randomized controlled clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, we have to formulate the Cosmos Caudatus or ulam raja into a form that can be tested clinically and objectively.
Mm-hmm.
So we developed the supplements of ulam raja.
So it's ulam raja in the form of supplements, not in its original form.
Yeah, because in clinical trial, we can only do the studies up to 3 months in our study. If we use that in original form, and if we want to look, you know, of ulam raja with diabetes, with hypertension and so on, we can do in original form because the dosage is not as much as needed for the brain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When we benchmark most of the studies that, you know, like green tea study, pine bark study overseas, you know, when they look into herbal and the brain, so they need a higher amount
of
polyphenols or vegetables and so on. So it's not possible to have a person to take this higher amount of ulam raja for a short period of time and to measure the impact on the brain. Because in our study, we use MRI, the brain imaging, questionnaire on cognition, taking the blood and things like that. So that's why we developed the supplements.
Prof, can I ask, so earlier you mentioned that, I think in the first study you said that you looked at how many servings they were having a day. So what do you what do you consider as a serving of an ulam in its kind of natural form?
Okay, one serving of ulam is supposed to be around 40 grams per day. It's about one cup, or one plate of ulam, right?
I see.
So many people not consuming this, only about quarter to half serving per day, right? And this is among the adults and also older adults from the low to middle income residential areas in Klang Valley, right? But when we actually do further analysis, we want to know what is the level of the ulam that should be consumed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because we found that earlier, ulam, those who are taking ulam, has a lower waist circumference, right? And so on. So we found that those who are taking at least one serving per day would be enough to ensure that they have a better health as compared to those who are not taking ulam.
And this is specifically ulam raja, right, you were looking at, or it was
a mix? That was general ulam.
That was general ulam.
Total ulam consumption. But for the purpose of clinical trial, Dr. Mm-hmm. Azimah, we just choose ulam raja.
Sure.
Because you have to standardize it, right?
Yeah, we have to standardize and so on.
And it's the king of ulam.
It's a cosmos goddess. Yes. King of the ulam.
So then, Prof. Susanna, what have your studies found so far in terms of the link between the consumption of ulam raja and any improvements in brain health?
Yeah, because we found that those, because we actually we do this study with a proper clinical trial, of which we develop a capsule with ulam and we compare that with placebo. Mm-hmm. Of which placebo is identical pills which, don't have ulam inside lah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So then we randomize them. So of which we and also our respondents and also the assessor do not know who got ulam or who didn't got ulam, mm-hmm. right? And we gave them for three months, about 12 weeks. So each one of them would take two tablets. Mm-hmm. So if the subject happens to get the cosmos caudatus, so the total dosage is about 500 milligram of cosmos caudatus. So of which is quite a lot lah if we want to take orally.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Then after that, we measure a lot of things, as I mentioned, especially the MRI, the brain function, the cognition, using the neuropsychological battery, the mood, and also take the blood for oxidative stress, lipid peroxidation. Yeah. And we found that those who consume ulam, among all the batteries of neuropsychological battery, we found that ulam consumption improved MMSE. MMSE is a tool to assess the global cognitive function. Better, less tension,
mm-hmm.
and better mood as compared to those who are not taking ulam or those who got the placebo, which doesn't have ulam inside.
Mm.
And also we measure the brain activation.
Mm-hmm.
The brain activation, the part of the memory, being triggered among those who are consuming ulam as compared to those who are not consuming the ulam.
Mm. Do we know what might explain that link between the consumption of ulam and those improvements that you mentioned?
It's probably due to the content of the ulam, which is the flavonoids or quercetin and quercitrin.
Mm-hmm.
Quercetin and quercitrin is two types of polyphenols or flavonoids that have been proven in other studies in other countries, like in Japan, and of which when they administer the quercetin and quercitrin supplementation, in chemical forms, and they found that it's protective for the brain, right? So ulam has that kind of properties naturally. So it's not a surprise that ulam actually can improve the brain function due to the amount of the quercetin and quercitrin inside the ulam.
So I'm curious that you mentioned that it also has a positive effect on mood. Can you say more about that?
Yeah.
Is that also related to the flavonoids that you were talking about?
Yeah. Because quercetin and quercitrin, it has... We can the mechanism may be a lot we did not know yet, kan, Dr. Azina? Mm-hmm. Every time, the more we study, the more we do not know, actually. Okay. Number one is, I would say that calcitrin and calcitrin, you know, is a molecule that can pass through the blood-brain barrier that has a significant effect lah, to the neurons and so on that trigger the positive part of the memory in the brain. And number two, calcitrin and calcitrin and also other components in ulam, like ulam raja is rich in vitamin C as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rich in potassium. So this can reduce the oxidative stress, because we know that with aging, we have higher oxidative stress that relate to diseases and so on, and also to one extent is to the mood.
So I just wonder, because, you know, I whether or not it's related to like the part of our brain that we call the reward pathway. So when we do something that we know is good for us, you actually, you know, you feel good because you're doing it and then you keep doing it, right? So whether or not that has a knock-on impact on the mood, because, you know, you're kind of telling yourself, I'm looking after my brain and I'm doing good things, and that will kind of also make you feel good about, you know, life.
Because you're eating healthier, right? So yeah, it's that pathway, yeah.
Yeah, and it's actually a very important pathway, because it motivates you to keep doing it, you know?
But we have to remember that in this study, we have a placebo group.
Sure.
You see the change in the placebo group. You know,
sure.
The group, they don't actually exhibit any change on their mood status lah.
And this group would be thinking that they might be eating healthier also, right?
So we have placebo effect lah here, kan? No placebo effect.
Wow, that's interesting. So not just the part of the brain which is involved in memory, but also in, like, you're thinking it may also be releasing certain hormones or something.
Actually, we discussed about our findings this with our psychiatrist as well. We are thinking of designing another study. If we can actually do another trial, kan, Dr. Azlina, and to compare this ulam as compared to Xanax, for example, kan? For stress and anti-depression, right?
Mm.
So that is another thing that we would like to do lah in the near future.
Prof. Susanna, earlier you mentioned that from your earlier study, people usually consume about half a serving of ulam a day, right?
Or less.
So if people are usually consuming half a serving of ulam or less in a day, how does that compare to if we were to convert the supplements that you provide to people who are part of the trial, right? How many servings would that actually be, you know, if you were to consume ulam as it is?
It's about 9 to 10 times higher than that.
Oh, God.
You get bloated.
My goodness.
You get bloated.
Wow.
Oh, so that's like a lot more. That's probably, if it's 9 to 10 times higher, then I guess that would be about like 5 to 6 servings a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then what advice would you have for people then who think like, oh, I should consume 5 to 6 servings of ulam a day?
Yeah, what I would say that if we start early, right, what most important is start your lifestyle changes early, you know, from childhood, you know, adolescent or us, you know, in the adulthood. And we regularly consume ulam at least one serving, like 2 to 3 times a week, not to miss ulam. It's not like ulam we take this month, but only next month then we take, Dr. Azina can know, right? And we consume habitually and plus other, you know, effort for lifestyle, healthy lifestyle and so on. I think that will be fine. If we don't have any problems, like we are not having any problem like pre-dementia and so on, that would be fine. Mm. Only those with, you know, clinical condition and so on that might benefit for supplements, providing that we have to conduct more trials for this kind of, to really confirm on the effect on the larger samples, longer trials.
Mm.
Into other parameters as well.
And I guess, speaking of supplements, you know, we're talking about diet and the brain health. I have to ask both of you what you both think about these brain food fats that we always see, right? I think, and I'm thinking in two different categories here. On one hand, you have people promoting whole foods, things like berries or nuts or, you know, things like ginkgo, as saying that, oh, okay, this is good for your brain health. And then on the other hand, you also have people promoting supplements that are, you know, supposedly able to make you study better or remember things better. What do both of you make of these brain food fats? You know, is there any truth to them?
Well, if you ask me, I'm actually a dietitian. So for us, food is the best. Because food in the natural form, it has lots of nutrients, fiber, you know, it's not being oxidized yet. Because when you process it as a supplement, you know, some of the nutrients, components and so on might be losses during the processing. And it's very cheap to take a natural food. And it's very cheap just to grow your own ulam, you know, in the office or at the backyard and so on. It's very cheap. Providing you start early, you have it regularly and so on. I think that will be fine as compared to taking supplements is in addition to the problem with nutrient losses, and it's also problem with you take the high dosage. There's a concern about, you know, interaction with other medications and so on. And we also do not know what are the ingredients sometimes being put up in the supplements, right? It may be a true good effect, or it might be other things that might not be so good, you know. And what is the long-term effect of the supplement on organs like kidney, the heart, and so on? We don't know of that. And number three, it's quite expensive, lasso.
Especially when people can buy all these supplements simply just over the counter, right? You may not even speak to a pharmacist before buying the supplements. You may not even consult with a medical professional before buying and consuming them.
I mean, for me, I guess I've never really been a fan of pill popping. I don't like taking, you know, medicine in capsules or tablets or anything. So if I have an option, I always go for the fresher form.
Why do you think people tend to believe in this supposedly miracle brain foods, you know, that help kids to study better or adults to remember better? Is it just because of that ease of pill popping?
I mean, I saw it a lot when my children were younger, you know, with the adverts and take DHA, for example, and omega-3 and everything. But, you know, I mean, I can understand how that might be something that makes the parent feel that you are doing good by your child by giving them these supplements. But you know, I mean, as Prof. Susanna was saying, you know, a lot of the time you do also worry what are the other things, and, you know, are they really getting the right dose? And also it tends to kind of make you you kind of neglect other things that you know, you think that you put all your hope on the supplements and you don't actually kind of make sure that they're getting a balanced diet. So, I mean, you know, of course, they may have some benefit, but I think to kind of, you know, don't go overboard on it. You know, I mean, like you can have, say, you know, it's a small part of your daily kind of routine, but don't think that it's going to be a magic bullet to make you healthy.
And I think if you need to take that, you need to consult the doctor, the pharmacist and dietitians. And normally they would just ask you to take that during a specific period of time, okay, when you really require that. And in case of deficiency, you know, if you are okay, there's no deficiency, there's no need to take, because that might result in overdosage. But,
you know, being healthy and having, you know, a brain which is fit and, you know, at level of fitness it actually requires, you know, having a good lifestyle and good diet, you know, over decades. You know, it's not just taking it when you are, you know, 70 years old and thinking that, you know, it's going to perhaps reverse some of the damage that has already happened. So we need to kind of, you know, people need to realize that that has to, you know, in your 30s, 40s, you know, you already need to sort of start thinking very carefully about your diet and overall lifestyle.
I think hearing and speaking to all medical experts from various fields, right? Doctors, pharmacists, dietitians, and nutritionists, you know, you can easily tell no one, none of them will tell you if that there is there's ever an easy answer to any illness or to, you know, to any improvements in health. It's always small incremental changes that you have to implement over time. I think every one of us wants a quick and easy fix, but unfortunately, life is not that way. And before we wrap up, can I get a final message from both of you? I'll start with you, Prof. Susanna. You know, what would be your take-home message about diet and the brain, or about ulam and the brain? You know, what do you want people to take away?
Well, I would say for people to seriously, you know, incorporate ulam in our daily diet in the family. And I'm so worried about the younger generation, Sue, you know, because they want a quick thing. And the westernized diet is more popular as compared to our traditional local ulams, right? So we have to do more promotion on this. And I would like to see ulam is a special important role in the community. Like, for example, if you go to Thailand and Korea, can we go eating, you know, at the restaurant there, there's a bunch of ulam on their tables, you know, for us to just take with whatever meals that we you know, ordered at the restaurant. And we have that kind of thing in Malaysia. Okay, so, and number two, I would say that we have to, you know, be more interested on health, right? Like Dr. Azina mentioned, the concern of parents on you know, to get their kids smarter, and you know, they go for DHA and things like that. So actually, we did some analysis on DHA, Dr. Azina. To get a 500 milligram of DHA, you just have to consume one piece of, for example, fish. Our pompress, so it's already sufficient.
Right? So doable. Yeah.
And when you do the markets, we did the market analysis. You know, some of the companies promoted DHA in their milk, and they say that this is four times higher DHA. But that's wrong. It's four times higher DHA than their previous formula. And we look into the level of DHA in that particular milk, it doesn't actually meet the level that we can get DHA from fish itself. So I would say natural is the best, and never ever doubt the natural.
I definitely agree with that.
Anything else you'd like to add, Dr. Azina?
Yeah, I don't know if you saw recently, there was a story about a couple at their wedding reception for their dog gift. Rather than giving, you know, like chocolates or whatever, they were giving vegetables. Did you see that?
No.
So the guests went home carrying vegetables. And, you know, I wonder, you know, how lovely would that be, an idea where, you know, ulam could be, you know, a little small plant of ulam, you know, that you take home, or Brazil spinach or something like that, you know, so lovely to have in your kitchen growing, and you know, such a meaningful dog gift or birthday present or whatever, you know. So I'd like to see, you know, people considering that kind of thing, diversifying the kind of gifts that you think of giving people.
And it's, you know, I'm thinking back of what both of you have said. It's the little steps, right? You know, just every other meal, maybe, you know, incorporate a bit of ulam into your meal, or a bit more vegetables and things like that. And it's the small steps that, you know, slowly you build habits to eat healthier, to lead healthier lifestyles. Yeah. And on that note, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to neurogeneticist Dr. Azina Ahmad Anwar and Dr. Susanna Shahar, professor in nutrition and dietetics at University Kebangsaan Malaysia, for our regular Brainwaves segment. I'm Lim Suan, and this has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.